Hey, you looking for a job? Because it looks like there's still an opening at the Fed. Apply within. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 11th of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We begin today with a math problem, a political math problem. In some degree, yes, I will grant you this, but one with an economic kicker. Republicans control 53 seats in the United States Senate, as the politically inclined among you will know. Nominees to certain federal offices require 51 votes to be confirmed. So if, say, four Republican senators decide they are not going to vote for a given nominee, that person's path to confirmation becomes difficult. And that is where retired pizza mogul and friend of President Trump, Herman Cain, finds himself today. Mr. Cain, also a 2012 presidential hopeful and a holder of unorthodox economic views, has been floated by the president as a possible nominee to the Federal Reserve's Board of Governors. Today, as I alluded to, a fourth GOP senator came out and said he would be a no on Mr. Cain. The official line from the White House, by the way, in the person of National Economic Council Director Larry Kudlow just this morning, is that the White House still supports Mr. Cain's nomination. Not in the news so much the past couple of days, as Mr. Cain has been getting all the heat, are the controversies, both political and personal and economic, surrounding the president's other potential nominee, Stephen Moore, who you also might have heard of. All right, now we're going to talk about something we used to talk about a lot, but lately and luckily we don't have to so much anymore. People losing their homes because they can't pay their mortgages. Foreclosures the first quarter of this year fell to their lowest level in more than a decade. That's according to a report out today from Atom Data Solutions. Credit, of course, a strong economy and a robust job market. But despite that, the news isn't all good in all parts of this economy. In some cities, Baltimore, Washington, D.C., Philadelphia, all on the East Coast, to name just a couple, foreclosures are still above their pre-recession averages. In some cases, actually by a lot. Marketplace's Amy Scott went in search of the why.
In Baltimore, foreclosures are nearly triple what they were before the recession, up 189%. In D.C., they're up 26%. In Philadelphia, 20%. All told, 40% of the cities Atom Data Solutions looked at have more foreclosures now than when the housing market started to collapse.
You're sort of seeing the last vestiges of the crisis.
That's Lori Goodman with the Urban Institute's Housing Finance Policy Center. She says in some states, the foreclosure process can take years because it involves the courts.
And most of the places that have foreclosures well above the national average and well above pre-recession levels are judicial states.
Sam Cater, chief economist at Freddie Mac, keeps up with foreclosure filings in the D.C. area by reading the newspaper. He says even for new filings, a lot of the loans were made before the crash.
Folks that were barely hanging on the whole time and for one reason or another couldn't hang on anymore.
In Baltimore, it feels like the crisis never ended. Owen Jarvis is director of legal services at St. Ambrose Housing Aid Center. He says the center still gets hundreds of calls a year from people in danger of losing their homes.
It's definitely got a Groundhog Day feel to it. There's a ton of people, more than we can help as substantively as we'd like, who are struggling.
Ironically, in some places, the strong housing market is part of the problem. Attorney Irwin Trouse helps people facing foreclosure in Philadelphia. He says as property values go up, so do property taxes.
When there's a reassessment in the taxes, it makes the monthly mortgage payment harder to pay.
Overall, though, homeowners are in better shape than they have been in decades. Again, Sam Cater.
The dollar volume of home equity that Americans have is the highest it's ever been, and that serves as a really nice large cushion in case home prices decline.
And in most places, home values are still rising. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, we are going to have a new ticker symbol to keep track of sometime soon. Starts with a U, ends with B-E-R. Uber officially filed for its much anticipated initial public offering today. As we told you yesterday, the company is going to wind up with a valuation of something like $100 billion. Here's just a couple of relevant figures from the filing. 91 million Uber users at the end of last year. It lost $1.8 billion in 2018. That's on revenues of a little bit more than $11 billion. Travis Kalanick, by the way, the founder and one-time CEO of that company, $8.5 billion to the upside for him. Shares probably start trading next month. Wall Street proper today, mostly quiet ahead of earnings season, which starts next week. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's been another huge storm doing its thing in the Midwest this week, the second biggie in about 3-4 weeks. Last time, you might remember, there were massive floods. Farms and whole communities and the businesses in them were underwater. Lagoon Pumping and Dredging in Columbus, Nebraska was one of them. It's Aaron Ross's company. He has a family business. We talked to him about a day or two after the floods hit, and with more weather upon him now, we dialed him up again today. Hey, Mr. Ross, it's Kai Rizdahl in Los Angeles. Sir, how are you?
Pretty good. Thank you.
How's it going? We just wanted to call and check back in with another storm coming and you with the flooding and everything. How are you getting by?
Well, fortunately in this area, we just received rain instead of snow, and that helped us a bunch. The rain, of course, has caused everything to be extremely muddy again.
Yeah.
But at least it's not snow.
Well, yeah, I bet. When last we spoke, I guess it was like 3-ish weeks or so ago, it was the day after the floods, maybe 2 days after, and you were still digging out. How did the digging out go?
Well, we hope to finish the dig out this week. We're not quite done yet, but we hope to finish this week. And that has been a drawn-out process. We hired extra help. There's been about 20 people every day working on it.
Wow.
Pulling equipment and parts and everything out of the mud, taking it over to a warehouse that we rented, power washing everything off and putting it in the warehouse and trying to, we haven't even started sorting through it yet.
Do I remember right that you said you had like $200,000-ish worth of damage that you were thinking?
We had $200,000 worth of insurance. We had $600,000 damage done to the building.
Oh, man.
But we've been totaling up the rest of the losses, like any equipment and tools and inventories, and it's about $0.2 million.
So what are you going to do? Those are big numbers.
Those are big numbers. We're not quitters, but it's going to take a while to build that back up.
Yeah, I bet. And these folks you got working for you, the 20 that are coming in every day, in addition to the family members I understand you have going on, are you going to be able to keep them on for a while? Do you have enough cash flow to keep them going?
No, this is the last week. I told everybody I would keep them through this week. The cash flow is, it's not cash flow anymore. It's reserve money.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're burning through that pretty fast.
Yeah, I guess you're not actually making any money, so you don't have any cash flow.
Right.
When we had you on last time, there was like a gas station or something across the street. I guess the question is, what's the environment like? How's everybody else doing?
Well, those guys, they're still digging out. This last week, they were working on their yard, and they haven't got the concrete poured yet, but they're getting real close to being ready. They had to clean their building out entirely, and they finished that this week also. Now they're going to go in and start rebuilding. They do plan to reopen.
Can I ask you how old you are, Mr. Ross?
I'm 62 years old.
So you're going to be doing this for a while longer, I guess, if you're making this kind of investment in time and energy now, huh?
Yes, it's going to take a while to recuperate, and pretty soon I guess the boys are going to have to finish paying for it.
Aaron Ross, he's the CEO of Lagoon Pumping and Dredging. We got him in Columbus, Nebraska. Mr. Ross, thanks for your time, sir. I appreciate it. Best of luck to you.
Thank you.
There are more than 1,500 cities, counties, and states in this country that are suing pharmaceutical companies over their role in the opioid crisis. The great tragedy of that epidemic, of course, is the huge cost in human lives, 50,000 people a year, according to the Centers for Disease Control. But there are lingering and very real economic effects as well. Lost wages, more spending on prisons, the cost of treatment and services. Our podcast, The Uncertain Hour, has been on the ground in Wise County, the mountains of way southwestern Virginia, for 2 years now, looking into what that crisis means in that slice of this economy, where the number of inmates in the county jail in Wise has more than doubled since 2005, even as the overall population has declined. The Uncertain Hour's Caitlin Esch looked into an experimental program to shrink the jail population and those costs I was talking about that come with it.
If you visit Wise County, you might see people out painting lines on the Little League field or fixing the town pool or working the front desk at the community college library.
Womper Library, this is Jesse. How can I help you?
These are not paid employees or volunteers. They're felons working off their drug charges. Under a new program called Wise Works, a small number of people convicted of nonviolent crimes, mostly related to drugs, are sentenced to work instead of jail. Take 29-year-old Jessie Schuler. That was her answering the phone at the library. She started taking painkillers, mostly OxyContin, soon after she graduated from high school.
At first you think, oh, you know, I have more of a willpower. This will just kind of be like a weekend thing. And it doesn't. It never ends up that way.
Jessie was addicted to painkillers till she was in her mid-20s, when she finally left Wise and got into treatment.
I moved to Asheville. I was in a halfway house for a few months and got a job, was going to meetings, got that group of friends that was really dedicated to that. And then I met my fiance and I just never looked back.
But when she applied for a passport recently, she found out there was a warrant out for her arrest on charges for check fraud, grand larceny, and prescription fraud. Back when she was in the throes of addiction, she would write and cash checks in her father's name. Jessie immediately returned to Wise County, found a lawyer, and turned herself in.
I was a wreck the whole time. I've never been in trouble. And the not knowing, you know, he could not guarantee me that I would just go in and come right back out, that they would give me the bond or anything. You know, I had no idea.
At the time, her son was just 8 months old.
And I'm sitting here thinking, am I going to miss his first steps? Am I going to miss him walking?
In the end, Jessie didn't miss her son's first steps. She took a plea deal and joined Wise Works. Instead of jail, she was sentenced to 1,440 hours of work without pay. She had to move back to Wise County. She brought her son and lived with her mom during the week. Jessie was careful not to fall back into old habits.
I don't go out. I don't go see friends. I just, you know, I have my son here and I'm here and then I'm to my mom's and then I go home on the weekends.
It took her 9 months working full time to finish her work sentence. She's back home now in North Carolina with her family, has another baby on the way.
I mean, it just absolutely terrifies me to think that I could be sitting in jail right now.
The county's elected prosecutor, Chuck Slemp, says until recently, there weren't really any alternatives to incarceration except for a small drug court program.
Probation or jail. That's all we've got.
The idea for Wise Works came when he was running for office in 2015 and knocking on doors.
Almost every single person said one of two things. You got to do something about those bad doctors. And I can't believe that they locked up Uncle Johnny. Uncle Johnny was a good guy. He needed help, not jail.
Wise Works is based on a similar program one county over. Instead of jail time, participants plead guilty to felonies and are sentenced to hundreds, sometimes thousands of hours of community service. Lots of people work full time and raise kids on top of that. Still, for many, like Jessie Schuler, it beats jail.
You hear stories of the drugs being in the jail or, you know, you get right back up with people who are not ready to change. They'll just come in, do their time, go back and do the same thing. And I could be right there going the opposite direction.
The program is just a year and a half old. About 50% of people finish. The rest are removed for some violation and end up serving jail time anyway. Right now, there are just 25 participants. But Wise Works is paying off. Nonprofit organizations like soup kitchens and local government agencies saved more than $200,000 in labor costs since the program began. And participants have collectively avoided thousands of days in jail. I'm Caitlin Esch for Marketplace.
The newest episode of The Uncertain Hour is out today. Follow along with an undercover cop in Wise after he goes after dealers and pill mills in town. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts. Yeah. Coming up.
This is a harder one than a strike for, from the standpoint of a viewer, because it's not a situation where suddenly everything's going to go dark.
Television doesn't just write itself, you know. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial down 14 points today, less than a tenth percent, 26,143. The NASDAQ down 16 points, that's less than two-tenths percent, 79.47. The S&P 500 basically flat, 28.88. Rite Aid reported weaker than expected numbers for the fourth quarter today. Stock closed down 9.4% today. Staying with drugstores, Walgreens down nearly 2%. CVS down 2.1%. We mentioned Uber. How about Lyft? Went public a couple of weeks ago, up 1.5% today. Still about 10 bucks below its IPO price last time I checked. Bed Bath & Beyond, fourth quarter same-store sales failed to impress, losing customers apparently to online retailers. Bed Bath & Beyond down 8.7% today. There were winners. Caesars Entertainment rose 3.8% on news it might be putting itself up for sale the next couple of days. PagerDuty, which makes tools for software developers, spiked more than 59% on an IPO. Today, you're listening to Marketplace.
And now, a word from our sponsors at Betterment. Do you want your money to dream big? Do you want your money to be a total self-starter? Are you annoyed that your money doesn't work hard enough? Don't worry. Betterment is here to help. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Their automated technology is built to help maximize returns, meaning when you invest with Betterment, your money can auto-adjust as you get closer to your goal, rebalance if your portfolio gets too far out of line, and your dividends are automatically reinvested. That can increase the potential for compound returns. In other words, your money is breaking a sweat while you can be breaking bread. You'll never picture your money the same way again. Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. There was a corporate bankruptcy filing this week that needs not to go unremarked upon. The company that launched Ebony and Jet magazines, Johnson Publishing Company of Chicago, filed Chapter 7 bankruptcy on Tuesday. Chapter 7 is liquidation. Remember, it's not restructuring, so this company is going out of business. Johnson sold off its magazines in 2016, but it held on to its Fashion Fair cosmetics line. And when Fashion Fair hit the market in 1973, department store counters that sold it were among the few places where women of color could buy shades that suited their skin. There are, of course, a lot more options today, and the brand has been struggling, which could be a bit of a problem as the company is trying to sell off Fashion Fair as part of that liquidation. Marketplace's Erica Barris is on that one.
For decades, Fashion Fair was synonymous with beauty and glamour. It offered women of color foundation in a spectrum of brown shades and lipsticks in darker, more flattering hues. But over the past few years, it had to issue a product recall, and it had inventory issues. Toya Mitchell, an analyst with Mintel, says that hurt its standing with longtime customers.
That means that an older consumer is going in-store looking for her Fashion Fair products.
And when she doesn't find them, she's not going back. So she's probably buying online, where she'll find a lot of competing brands. Rihanna's brand Fenty has had explosive success and forced others to offer shades beyond just cocoa and caramel. Patrice Yersic blogs at Afrobella.
There's so many more products that are available for our skin tones. If you're a person who's into cosmetics and you walk into, let's say, your Sephora or your Ulta or your Macy's, there's more options for you now than there used to be.
Fashion Fair still has its legacy going for it, but that might not be enough to make it stand out as retailers shift to selling all the foundation at one counter and all of the lipstick at another. Besides, Sucharita Kadali at Forrester Research says, shoppers are fickle.
Shoppers want newer brands, and they're often very disloyal. And what I mean by that is they often will try new things.
Kadali says finding a buyer for Fashion Fair is going to be an uphill battle, but its potential market may be big enough to attract an investor. Black women spent $1.7 billion on cosmetics last year. I'm Erica Barris for Marketplace.
There's a story out of Hollywood this week that's a little bit inside baseball, a little bit organized labor, and a whole lot of money, and who gets it? Writers and the big talent management agencies are at an impasse over how those agencies represent those writers, and again, how the money gets divvied up. There's a Friday midnight deadline, at which, if the two sides can't come to terms, writers, we are told, are going to fire their agents. We got entertainment lawyer Jonathan Handel, also a contributing editor at The Hollywood Reporter, on the phone to explain what is going on here. Jonathan, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you.
Could you, in the vernacular of Hollywood, could you give me like the 30-second elevator pitch on what this whole thing is about, please?
Well, it's a complicated one. This is the writers versus their own agents rather than versus the employers, which is what you usually see in a labor dispute. It's not writers versus studios. It's writers versus agents. The Writers Guild and the talent agents both represent the writers, but the Writers Guild feels, and many writers feel, that the way that talent agents are compensated is unfair. They're not typically compensated with 10% of the writer's salary. Huh. Instead, they get paid by the studios, what's called packaging fees, and that creates a conflict of interest in the view of the Writers Guild.
So tell me about how this packaging works then.
The way packaging works is that an agent typically puts a writer together, we're talking television in particular, mm-hmm. with a star. The writer has a script, a pilot script, and they take that package to a studio, and you're off to the races.
And the complaint from the writers then is you're not representing us, and somehow we're not getting as much money as we ought to get, right?
The writers feel that because the agencies are potentially getting enormous sums of money, in the case of a successful show, that the agencies really are not negotiating aggressively on behalf of the writers. They're not taking 10% of the writer's salary. Instead, they're getting money directly from the studios. They've also not been happy more recently with a practice called affiliate production, where the talent agencies are actually setting up their own affiliated production companies and going into business as mini studios themselves.
Huh. So what we've got the writer's point of view here. What are the agencies saying?
The agencies say two things. First of all, that in fact, writers tend to make more money because they don't have to pay commission when you're talking about packaging arrangements. And as far as affiliate production goes, the agencies say, you know, this is bringing new buyers into the marketplace. We're actually giving better deals to writers. Mm-hmm. And in fact, the president of the Writers Guild East is in business with one of these companies. He has done a deal with one of the affiliated production companies precisely because the deals are better than what the studios offer.
The writers have proposed this thing called the Code of Conduct. First of all, what is it? And second of all, what happens if agencies say, nah, we're not signing that?
The way things work right now, for the last 43 years, there's been an agreement between the Writers Guild and the Association of Talent Agents. That agreement is set to terminate in Friday night, in fact. They want to replace it with a quote-unquote Code of Conduct that would prohibit packaging fees and affiliate production. None of the major agencies are going to sign that. Few, if any, of the mid-tier agencies will sign it. And as a result, writers by the thousands will be ordered by the guild, unless there's a solution reached before then, to fire their own agents. That could lead to massive litigation in both directions and certainly to a great degree of uncertainty as to how people are going to find jobs.
Okay, so not to make this all about me, but let's make it all about me as a proxy for the viewing and content-consuming public out there. Is content going to go away? Are we going to lose peak TV and all that great stuff that we're watching, Game of Thrones and all of that? I mean, Game of Thrones is going to be done, but you know what I mean.
Well, this is a harder one than a strike from the standpoint of a viewer, because it's not a situation where suddenly everything's going to go dark. At the end of the day, I don't think that the viewer is going to see an enormous difference one way or another here, to be quite frank.
Jonathan Handel, he's an entertainment attorney, also contributing editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Jonathan, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thanks very much.
This final note on the way out today, I'm going to name you a couple of companies, big household name type companies. You tell me what they have in common, all right? And here's a hint as you try to think about the answer. Keep an eye on the calendar. All right, so here they are. Amazon, Netflix, Chevron, Eli Lilly as well. I could go on, but it's only a half an hour program. According to some reporting from the Center for Public Integrity and Research by the Washington-based think tank Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, those companies and about 50 others reported that their 2018 federal tax rates came to just about zero on income earned on U.S. operations. Part of that is smart tax lawyers on staff, sure. Part of it, the research shows, is because of the GOP's 2017 corporate tax cut. Taxes, by the way, Monday. All right, we got to go. Dow off 14 today, less than a tenth percent. NASDAQ down 16, two-tenths percent. S&P 500 basically flat. Amir Babawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Heron Bikella, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is Deirdre Debke. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.